Hi, I'm Greg Harris, present CEO of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and you're listening to the Music Journeys podcast.
Welcome to the Music Journeys podcast. I'm Mike Foley. A couple of the greatest moments of my radio career have come in covering the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction ceremonies in 2015 and 2018. 2015, for instance, started with Joan Jett and the Blackhearts performing with Dave Grohl. In fact, the first thing I can remember seeing upon entering Cleveland's Public Auditorium was Jett warming up for that performance. In the middle of the ceremony, you have Stevie Wonder, John Legend, and Bill Withers on stage together performing after Bill's induction. Then it closed with Paul McCartney inducting Ringo Starr, and then just about every musician there playing with the two Beatles for the finale. To have the opportunity to be behind the scenes, in the press room, out on the red carpet as many of the musicians walked in, and to thank them for the music they've been a part of, and with the help of my Rock Hall correspondent, Jack Marchbanks, to be able to take listeners there with us in the specials we produced following those ceremonies, I just felt an overwhelming sense of gratitude. Still do for the musicians, of course, but for the chance to document the proceedings. I'll save my favorite moments from those for another time because I want to get to our guest right away. But as we draw closer to this year's induction ceremony, which returns to Cleveland, we'll bring some of those moments to you in this podcast, and maybe we'll pull those specials out of the archives and make them available for a limited time here soon. On this edition of Music Journeys, it's Greg Harris, who served as president and CEO of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and Museum since 2013. Our first chat came in late September of last year here at WCBE, followed by monthly phone conversations. On the Music Journeys podcast, Harris shares his personal path to Cleveland, steps that included running a record store and working at the Baseball Hall of Fame. He'll explain the selection process, talk about this year's inductees, respond to criticism regarding a lack of women in the Rock Hall, and discuss the museum's transformation headlined by two recent exhibits. We'll also take you inside the Rock Hall in Cleveland to hear how the opening of one of those exhibits sounded, and we'll do so with the help of four Rock and Roll Hall of Famers. Greg Harris, our featured guest on this edition of Music Journeys. Thanks for listening.
Hi, I'm Greg Harris, and I'm fortunate to be the president and CEO of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame Museum, I think the greatest museum in our entire country, because every single visitor has a lifetime of memories tied to the music in our museum, and it's a magical place because of that. And this is my music journey.
Cleveland-based musician Jewel Big Green warms up the crowd before the opening of a new exhibit at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and Museum. Even though four Hall of Famers were the big draw on this November night, there were pop-up performances like his scattered throughout the six-floor building. Greg Harris describes live music as a living, breathing art form, and it's something that's celebrated at the Rock Hall.
It's not just instruments and cases. We did 100 days of live music on our plaza this summer. So when you walk up to the museum, odds are there's going to be a band cranking, and you're going to feel the power of rock and roll. Our mission is to engage, teach, and inspire through the power of rock and roll. And when your mission is to do that, you can inspire and engage people in a lot of ways. So when we put a band on stage, it's very different than a place that puts a band on stage just for entertainment. For us, it's mission-centered. We put original music on our stage, and we expose people to the power of rock and roll.
Harris has served as president and CEO of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and Museum since 2013, but his love of music, museums, and stories began long before that. Among his jobs before coming to Cleveland, running a record store, managing a band, and working at the Baseball Hall of Fame.
I was born in the middle 60s in Trenton, New Jersey. and lived for the first 10 years of our life in New Jersey, and then the next 7 years across the river from Trenton in Pennsylvania. And in that part of the world, you know, Springsteen was everywhere. We all love Bruce. He was telling our stories and we connected with him in a really powerful way. I was listening to Philadelphia radio. I was listening to college stations out of Princeton and out of Trenton, and hearing alternative and punk and indie music from great college radio stations, along with the big FM stations that were playing, you know, the Grateful Dead and the Stones and David Bowie and stuff like that, as well as some AM stations that were playing great 50s oldies stuff. So that whole mishmash kind of brought it together for me. I play guitar, but not well. And back then I would listen and play and learn Chuck Berry and jam with people. But always on the band side, I ended up helping by running the sound or by moving the gear or by ultimately being the road manager and not being the person up on stage. When I road managed a band named the Ben Vaughn Combo, and we actually played Columbus quite a bit. Being not just loving music, but being able to live it and go to stations, frankly, like this, we would do this all over the country with the band and do in-studio sessions and then play in Columbia, Missouri or Lincoln, Nebraska or Sioux City, Iowa or Madison, Wisconsin. And all of that just cemented, you know, you're around people that love music as much as you do, and you kind of heighten each other. And now to be working at a place that celebrates this connection that we all have with rock and roll and the important moments of our life is just a dream come true. When I stand here and look back, it's a pretty straight line. But while it was happening, it didn't feel that way, especially, you know, dropping out of school and opening up the record store when your friends were finishing school and getting their first jobs, road managing a band and doing cross-country tours. And ultimately, you know, going to graduate school and working some other jobs, you know, starting businesses and doing other things, you felt like you were sort of zigging and zagging a little bit. And then to have the Baseball Hall of Fame experience for 14 years, the oldest and best established Hall of Fame in our country, they started in 1939 and are really best in class. And then to take that and apply it to a young place, to apply that to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, has just been a dream. And to have, you know, last night I was lucky enough to spend some time with Nick Lowe after his show.
If you think I'm glad, I'll say I'm more than that. I'm as glad as can be that somebody cared for me. Rock.
Connect with him and with his guitar player. Eddie Angel is one of the Low Straitjackets. And those are people that I met back in the 80s in the record store days while road managing other bands. And just, you know, this great sort of convergence and these circles all come together. I feel like I'm very fortunate. And the trick is to take a place that's as big and as strong as the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame with all these visitors, but still give it that DNA, that feeling that makes rock and roll so special and so powerful without it being, you know, overly slick. And overly commercialized. It has to be real. And I think by having this path, it gives you a good barometer to help keep it real. I think one of the most special aspects of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame is that every single visitor that walks through the front door has a lifetime of memory, a reservoir of life tied to this music. So when they hear a certain Creedence song, they think about the greatest road trip of their life. When they hear a Jackson Browne or a Carole King song,
music is playing inside my head over and over and over again, my there's no end to the music.
they might think about that time their heart was broken and how that music was there. They might think about somebody that they haven't seen in a long time, or they might think about all the other people that love the same thing. And there's a power in that connectedness, and that's rock and roll.
If there's one thing about the Rock Hall that divides music fans, it's the topic of who's in and who's not. First, let's have Harris outline the selection process.
There's a lot of talk about it because I don't think most people are aware of how it really works. There's a nominating committee. That committee is made up of a number of music critics, industry people, other musicians. You know, Tom Morello from Rage Against the Machine, Questlove from The Roots, Dave Grohl, folks like that are on the committee. And everybody nominates two. And there's a series, some rounds of voting, and it becomes a ballot of roughly 15. And the reason you nominate somebody is because of their impact and influence, not necessarily record sales, but did they take the art form and do something new and interesting and drive it in a new way? And it's why a band like the Velvet Underground... who in their lifetime probably sold 100 to 200,000 records, why they entered the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame before some artists that sold tens of millions of records. So there's that process. The ballot gets made. Then the ballot goes out to a voting body of about 1,000 people. And the largest voting block are all the other living inductees. So Bono votes, you know, Tina Turner votes, Smokey Robinson votes. And then the top five vote getters are elected to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. So it's election by your peers. And that's really meaningful. And the process itself has served us, I think, pretty well. You know, if you think about the millions and millions of people that have ever made records, millions of bands, there's only 330 elected to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. It's an incredibly exclusive club. Everybody feels like the band that they loved, that meant so much to them, is the greatest band in the world and should be inducted. That said, simply because they had a great record, one album, or a great moment, doesn't necessarily put them into that stratosphere. So people are passionate. What I love is that fans care who's in and who's out, and artists care. And that means that we're remaining relevant. And if people didn't care, that would be a bigger problem.
Fans do play a small role once the nominees are announced through online voting. In fact, this year, the Rock Hall partnered with Google so that just a simple search prompted a pop-up ballot.
Fans can vote once a day. They can pick their five that should be inducted. And what we do is we aggregate all the fan votes, and they form a composite ballot that gets tallied. In fact, it's two composite ballots that get tallied with the total. And quite frankly, the margin between the top five and maybe six and seven, it's a pretty thin margin. And so the fan vote does matter. We picked up this model from the Heisman Trophy. It's how they handle it. We've been doing it for about 3 years, and I believe last year we had about 3 million votes cast.
More than 8 million votes were cast for the 16 nominees announced in October. Pat Benatar, Dave Matthews Band, Depeche Mode, The Doobie Brothers, Whitney Houston, Judas Priest, Kraftwerk, MC5, Motorhead, Nine Inch Nails, Notorious B.I.G., Rufus featuring Chaka Khan, Todd Rundgren, Soundgarden, T-Rex, and Thin Lizzy. Fan reactions ran the gamut. Take Whitney Houston. Some wondered why she's not already in, while others questioned her inclusion in a rock and roll museum.
Your listeners are knowledgeable music fans. I think people will realize that rock and roll was never just for skinny guys with long hair and guitars. In the 50s, within the same canon, you've got street corner doo-wop harmony. You've got rip-roaring rockabilly. You've got dance songs, all called rock and roll. In the 60s, in the same section, in the rock section of the record store, you could have Simon and Garfunkel and Jimi Hendrix. And in the 70s, you could have Roxy Music, you could have the Allman Brothers, and you could have Depeche Mode, all considered rock. So, you know, that's the idea. It's never been just one thing. And when you look at artists like Whitney, she had such a massive influence in you know, greatest voice for generation. But her voice is incredibly versatile. It's powerful. She could connect with her audience in amazing ways. And a direct, you know, connection. Her legacy is Jennifer Hudson, Lizzo, Mariah Carey. And her influences were Aretha, the Jackson 5, and Mahalia Jackson. Just powerful stuff.
In the end, Houston was selected as a member of the 2020 class, along with Depeche Mode, Doobie Brothers, Nine Inch Nails, Notorious B.I.G., and T-Rex.
You think about the Doobie Brothers with kind of that wind-in-your-face, open road, California sound. Compare that to industrial Nine Inch Nails out of Cleveland, synth pop with Depeche Mode, or Notorious B.I.G. coming out of Brooklyn with pretty hard-hitting hip-hop. In Whitney Houston, you know, much like Marvin Gaye and Aretha, soulful ballads combined with sort of hard-hitting rockers as well as dance music. And then T-Rex, you know, the godfathers of glam rock, but they roll in that great crunchy sound, and they inspire Bowie, Elton John, Guns N' Roses, even Metallica, and you carry it through to Nirvana. Very, very different genres, but all under the great canon of rock and roll.
But the lack of women in the Rock Hall has been a source of contention among many fans. A recent NPR story included music writer Evelyn McDonald, who analyzed every band leader and member of a group and found that only 69 of the 888 inductees are women. That's less than 8%. Only one of the three female nominees made the 2020 class, but Harris remains optimistic that will change moving forward.
Overall, you know, the majority of our inductees have been male through the years, and it is a reflection of the music industry in general. When you look back at 1950s rock and roll, even 1960s rock and roll, it's heavily male-dominated. And as we move into further eras, you do get more women in rock, and our expectation is that the composition of the nomination will begin to reflect that more when we move into those eras. To be eligible for nomination to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, you had to have made a record 25 years ago, and this continues to evolve. The pool of eligibles continues to grow, but at the same time, you know, it's a process, and getting more women on the ballot, first of all, is really important. I certainly hope voters weren't thinking, well, I'm going to pick Whitney Houston and not Pat Benatar. You have five votes. You can vote for all the women on the ballot if you'd like. It's not an either or. So I hope that it continues to advance, continues to mature. The statistics that are out there, you know, they look at every single person that's been inducted, which is one way to look at it. Another way to look at it is there's 330 artists that are inducted, so that a band counts as a one. And using that math, we're at about 15% female, which is low, but in many ways I think is a reflection of the amount of music that was made in the 50s and 60s, and I think we get more of an explosion of female performers, especially in the 80s and 90s.
While there's debate about Rock and Roll Hall of Fame inductees, there's no doubt about the museum's transformation in Cleveland to a more engaging experience for music fans. Walk by the Garage exhibit and you can play the instrument of your choice or catch a group jamming.
We opened up a space on our second floor called the Garage, where visitors can play music and jam with each other. And magical things happen in there every day. You know, we had somebody that was just down from Toronto in playing with our group, and he was killing it on Stevie Ray Vaughan stuff. And seeing the joy on his family's face and other visitors to see that is pretty special. But at the same time, you know, we've had pros walk in there and surprise people. But I think that seeing the whole package come together and feeling like we built a space at the museum that was true to the independent record store vibe, true to the venue vibe, it's not too polished, it's not too perfect, it's authentic. And when visitors put a guitar around their neck, it's not a simulated Guitar Hero. It's a Telecaster. It's a Stratocaster. It's a Les Paul. And they're really playing these real instruments. There's a magic in that.
Then there's the most recent exhibit, Play It Loud, The Instruments of Rock and Roll, part of a philosophy to exhibit the best of the best, according to Harris.
We want that guitar that the song was written on, or that moment, not just a signed thing like the Hard Rock Cafe, iconic instruments. So there's a white Fender guitar that's central in that exhibit, and it is the guitar that Jimi Hendrix played the Star Spangled Banner at Woodstock on that guitar. So we exhibit the guitar. Those of us that know the story get goosebumps, but people that don't know the story, you're going to see Jimmy in context with it. You're going to see probably and hear video or see him playing it, so it gives a full curated experience. And it needs to have the bold statements that, say, a young person needs to know that in a time when our country, hundreds of thousands of people gathered in a field to question what it meant to be Americans, well, Jimi Hendrix played the most American of songs on this instrument. You want that moment in that storytelling piece that people can connect with.
At the official opening of the Play It Loud exhibit, Harris enlisted a little help from four Rock and Roll Hall of Famers.
It's the biggest exhibit the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame has ever done. The exhibit was co-created with the Metropolitan Museum of Art, and it was there all summer long and was setting all attendance records. Now it's in Cleveland for us to set those attendance records. We are grateful to our community, to our inductees, and there's a few of them here with us tonight. This exhibit is incredibly special. Many of these instruments have never been exhibited before, and they've never been in the same place at the same time. To give you a sense, many of them are still owned by the artist themselves. Now, usually when you open up an exhibit like this, you cut a big ribbon, right? This is a museum that's dedicated to rock and roll. We're gonna let rock and roll echo through this building, and that's how we're gonna open it, okay? So please join me in welcoming to the stage, from Heart 2013 inductee, Nancy Wilson.
Yes, the guitar that's in the exhibit, which, by the way, is astounding. I'm happy to open the exhibit tonight. There are so many things that not just only blew my mind to be in the same room with, or my guitar, but it bended my mind backwards and inside out and sideways. There are incredible things in there. You must check them out. My Blue Ovation carbon top from 1978 is featured when I was just a kid. And that guitar became a very close friend, wrote a lot of cool songs with me. And now sits next to the likes of Hendrix and Page and Clapton. So it is an honor and a privilege. And let me just tell you all here at the museum that's helped us present it, that you've been amazing, wonderful staff and team, and generous and super organized, which never happens. So... So thank you, and enjoy yourselves here at the Rock and Roll Altar.
Wilson did not perform, but the next guest did, former Eagles guitarist Don Felder.
Thank you. Thank you guys so much. You know, I came to this piece of property before there was anything standing here. It must have been, I think, the very end of the 70s, early 80s. And they had the foresight to bring me here and show us where this fantastic building was going to be built and tell us about where the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame was going to grow to. They said, up on the second floor, your exhibit's going to be up there with your guitar and your drums and stuff. And I'm looking around, and there is nothing there but this river out here. So they actually made this dream come true for all of you guys and for everyone to be able to come to this location and see and feel and know what rock and roll is. The history that you're gonna see here in this Play It Loud event is uncomparable to anything else you'll see. The legends that were there playing these guitars, Jimi Hendrix guitars, Clapton's guitars, the Everly Brothers guitars, Jimmy Page, everybody that was anybody is up there. And for my original double neck guitar to be hanging up there alongside of that kind of company is unbelievably an honor for me. So anyway, I can't thank you all enough here at the Rock Hall and all you people for the years you've put in to support the Eagles and the Eagles music. And we love playing for you. I don't ever have to play another live show for a dollar in my life. But the reason I'm here is because I love to play for you guys. You might remember this song from 1976.
Out the evening, Metallica's Kirk Hammett and Robert Trujillo, who shared quick stories and a jam session.
Oh, by the way, my guitar that's downstairs, I haven't seen that guitar in like 8 years. And it's a cool guitar, I remember. I think I took that one to Russia.
And my bass, that was a collaborative situation with my wife, Chloe, and it's the Aztec bass. And the last time I remember playing that thing was 80,000 people in Mexico City. So there's a great spirit to that instrument, and it represents everything from love to heavy metal.
Speaking of which.
All right, if you know the words, sing along.
Hey,
if you don't, headbang.
Hey, but you know what this feels like? This feels like one of our duets that we play live. It does. Okay. Ready?
We'll be right back.
Play It Loud, The Instruments of Rock and Roll runs through September 13th. Fans attending the exhibit's opening night seem to enjoy the experience. This Northern Ohio couple has also noticed a broader change at the museum.
Joe and Margaret Koenigsmark were from Lakewood, Ohio. Yeah, definitely gives you a little bit more than just looking at objects.
The vibe totally changed from when it opened up until now, because they have so many different interactive things. They've got bands, they've got events, they've got movies, they've got panels. We've been to a ton of different like panel discussions and stuff from photographers to band members, and it's been great. Yeah, yeah, we are really digging it.
As we look out into the future for the museum, you know, the on-site museum is terrific, and we want everybody to see it. We've been investing heavily in, we call it Museum 2.0. We've kind of rebooted the whole place. We built an immersive theater that we hired Jonathan Demme to do the edit for that just surrounds you in the greatest seats at any concert. But then outside of Cleveland, we have traveling exhibits that are in multiple cities right now. And then we have something that's called Rock Hall EDU, and it's our online learning platform. Any teacher that's out there, any student, go to the Rock Hall website. There's hundreds of assets that they can use in their classroom. You can talk about the March on Washington, and when you do, you can actually show footage of Dylan performing at the march, or Mahalia Jackson, or one of our curators talking about music in the civil rights movement, or music as a social force. And so Rock Hall EDU is a big way for us to impact a lot of people into sort of put rock and roll and history together to help tell a story, but help support curriculum materials that teachers are delivering anyway.
We had one last bit of fun with Greg Harris as he took part in the Fast Five. Here we go. Okay, first song you can remember hearing that you loved.
The first song I can remember hearing that I loved, I think it was a 45 record. It may have been off the American Graffiti soundtrack. It was a 3-record set, and we had the 45 as well, and it was Chuck Berry's Carol. Loved it. It was also my mom's name, and so I think I was drawn to it as a little kid, but hearing that was just pretty magical.
How about the song that makes you feel the most nostalgic or reflective?
Boy, there's a bunch that do that. One that does it growing up where I did in the circumstances that we were in, Springsteen's Backstreets gets it in a pretty big way. And also, I'll say I think Thunder Road, and I'll share because one, I've had the great pleasure of seeing him a lot, but then seeing him with my brothers who are great fans, and there's that great bond. And then my son is now a singer-songwriter, and he does an amazing version of it with an acoustic guitar in our kitchen that's just haunting. So maybe it's Thunder Road.
Well, I got this guitar.
Oh,
Okay, the go-to song that gets you dancing, or if you don't dance, a tune that you hear and you can't sit still when you hear it.
Yeah, I'd say a go-to song for waking up, right? I like kind of rockers, so the Stones, Rip This Joint.
Song that makes you feel like working out or motivates you to do something?
I think I answered that for the last one that motivates me for getting stuff done. You know, if I need a song to really pick me up because I've got some things to do, one that pops into my head is The Clash, Tommy Gunn. Just that drum, the way it kicks off, and that classic guitar banging in just makes you want to get stuff done. I'm kind of a lazy listener in a way. Like if I lived in Columbus, I'd be listening to the station all the time. I listen to our local, Kent State. I'll let them bring it. I'll listen online to WXPN out of Philly and let them bring it to me, or I'll pop on Sirius XM and let them bring it to me too.
Okay, last one. Song that lifts you up when you're feeling down.
These are great questions. The song that lifts me up when I'm feeling down, I immediately, without really even thinking, I thought about Otis Redding. Songs like These Arms of Mine.
These arms of mine, they are wanting, wanting to hold you. And if you
sad songs, but they bring you up. That sort of 60s soul that's almost country, that's Arthur Alexander-y, that stuff really picks me up.
And you heard Greg Harris mention his son, who's not only playing Springsteen covers in his kitchen, but also making his own music. We love hearing new musicians on Music Journeys, so here's a sample of young singer-songwriter Jack Harris.
Post on pages full of lies. Reveal now what's behind those eyes. Get the lights to feel alive. Doesn't matter what's inside as long as I can fake a smile. Hey, yeah, hey, yeah. Take my worries to the grave. Whoa, 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 whoa. All these things I'll never show. My heart.
Sample of No One Listens, the latest single from Jack Harris. You can find more information about and music from the younger Harris at jackharrissongs.com. And for Central Ohio listeners, you might find Harris performing in the area as he's continuing his education and music career in Columbus. My thanks to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and Museum's Greg Harris for visiting WCBE and all the chats that have taken place since. We hope to bring you more of his insight and reflection and updates as we get closer to the May 2nd induction ceremony, which returns to Cleveland's Public Auditorium. Special guests and presenters for the class of 2020 will be announced in the coming weeks. I'm Mike Foley. Talk to you again on the next Music Journey.